Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, Natasha Mitchell, joining you on the airwaves and online, and hope you've had a fabulous National Science Week wherever you are. On the show today, a deeply complex experience of the psyche. I wonder if you've seen the provocative TV series The United States of Tara, starring Toni Collette and directed by Steven Spielberg. It's screening on ABC One at the moment, and Toni Collette's character switches between alternative identities, or alters. There's Buck, the male redneck, Alice the prudish but feisty Stepford wife, T, the highly sexed teen, and then there's Tara herself, all occupying the one skin.
I just really resent picking up after them. I mean, not the kids, the alters. The messes they make can be astounding. I mean, having multiple personalities is like hosting a kegger in your brain. Only you're passed out cold while everyone else is just trashing the joint.
So I can't believe you guys went bowling without me.
We only went there because Buck has a thing for that hillbilly waitress at the snack bar. Look, we knew when you went off the meds, the whole gang would resurface.
Yeah, multiple personality reunion tour.
We always knew that stage would come back. Anyway, we can't begin to understand why you need them unless we let them show themselves.
You're right.
We all psychologically compartmentalise different traumatic experiences in our lives as a sort of self-protection measure. But for some, the burden of major trauma or abuse in childhood can prevent them from forming a cohesive sense of self at that critical age. The result can be what many psychiatrists describe as dissociative identity disorder, or DID. It has a very interesting history, which we might pick up on another show, because it's been a controversial diagnosis wrapped up in debates over false memories and the veracity of recollections about childhood abuse. But it's also an experience that really challenges the assumption that we occupy a bounded, singular self.
When's Mom coming back?
Tara is not equipped to manage this family at the moment. No, we've all come to a consensus, and I think you need me right now. That's enough with your gadget. You can communicate with your boyfriend later.
Alice, I don't have a boyfriend anymore because my mom turned into a man, came to school, and gimp slapped him while everyone I've ever met watched.
Well, he had bad genes. Your children would have been ugly and stupid.
Where are you going?
Just need some air.
I want to let you know that even though I deeply disapprove of the way you carry yourself, your mother loves you very much. She wants you to know she didn't mean to overreact about those pills you brought home. She just doesn't want you being intimate at your age. Because she had you at 19, and that was quite a hardship.
I'm not a hardship. I'm awesome.
I had a friend in all her best and loving caring offered to take me to her priest who did exorcisms, and I said, no, they're not demons, they're not, you know, they're part of me, you know, they're my emotions and they're my memories that have just split off and formed little identities of their own. I'm one person, but experientially they're different people or personalities. And to my friends that have known me long enough, I act differently, I look differently, I behave differently, and to them I am a different person. Yeah, you know, I've got friends that, yeah, they know that if they say hello and I ignore them, yeah, it's another part of me, so I'm not going to recognise them, so they don't get offended anymore. Everyone has just accepted it. But I knew one woman who was diagnosed. She had a friend, it was her best friend for 10 years. She went to this best friend and said, oh, I worked out why sometimes I don't remember things and that. Apparently I've got multiple personality disorder, because that's what it was called back then. She still behaved the same way as she did before, but now it had a name to it and it was a bit freaky. Her friend freaked out and never spoke to her again. That's why I'm willing to talk about it, because I don't have to hide it from anyone. It's sort of on behalf of other people, but I talk about my things mostly because, you know, as many ways as there are to traumatise a person, there's as many ways to express that.
What sorts of triggers are we talking about? I mean, you've dealt with some horrendous cases.
Yeah, yes.
That provoke someone to dissociate at the very time that their self is forming, is meant to be sort of associating.
What sets apart the group that developed DID is their trauma occurred in a recurrent way, in a way that was inescapable during a period in which they had not developed a full sense of self. So not only did they split off or switch out, but in fact, because they didn't have much of a core identity, it was relatively easy to actually make the formation of identity be around compartments rather than a core individual.
Professor Warwick Middleton is a psychiatrist in private practice and for the last 13 years director of the Trauma and Dissociation Unit at Belmont Hospital in Brisbane.
Just give you a very common trick. Just take a simple phrase like, can you just relax? That might sound pretty innocuous, doesn't it?
Mm.
But if that particular person, say, had a father or an uncle who characteristically initiated his sexual abuse by saying, just relax, then the mere use of that phrase may trigger an abrupt switch in the patient, and suddenly you've got someone who's accessed the compartment which contains the affect or memories associated with the abusive uncle or father, which when you explore with the patient the meaning of the term, then it suddenly makes a whole lot of sense.
So when a child starts dissociating, in a sense it's a form of psychological self-protection, is it? A sort of survival mechanism?
Yeah, it's trying to eke out a way of surviving something which is pretty barren and where one avoids content that would either drive you psychotic or cause you to suicide. So it's frequently the case the child is dependent on, as their primary caregivers, people who are their primary abusers. The abusive father can be split off in one compartment so that some sort of relationship can be constructed by the part that sees the father but doesn't have access to the memories of the abuse.
My name is Zoe Farris. I'm 53 years old. I was diagnosed as having dissociative identity disorder in 1991.
Where do you identify that this intense experience of dissociation comes from?
A lot of what I know comes from a few memories and a lot of what my brother told me. He still won't tell me a lot because it still upsets him too much because he remembers it all. We were raised by my grandmother and uncle, and uncle was an alcoholic and quite violent. So he used to bash his own mum up on a almost nightly basis when he'd get home drunk. I witnessed that, and I remember a few times being upstairs and crying my eyes out and screaming for him to stop it, and standing at the bottom of the stairs saying, if you keep that up, you'll cop it too. So one thing I clearly remember is laying on the bed with my brother sitting there with his hand over my mouth so I didn't make a noise. Another thing he used to do was he'd stick us out the front and say, don't come in till I tell you. And of course, being an alcoholic, he'd pass out and, we'd be sitting there all night going, do-do-do-do. So my brother and I would go play around the streets. So, there was that expectation of stress every night. Kids can't cope with that. I still have such loving memories of that uncle, but I must have separated him into two people so that I could, live and cuddle and play and everything with this good uncle. I don't know the logic of it or the psychology of it for me at that age because I was just too young.
Look, many will have heard the name multiple personality disorder.
Yeah.
More recently, since 94, I gather, it's been called dissociative identity disorder. Now, why the name change?
You can understand why in earlier days it was called multiple personality disorder because it actually feels like that and looks like it, when in reality it's truer to say that none of the identity states that one sees in DID are fully formed identities with full access to a narrative memory of their life and access to a full range of emotional responses that one would see in a usually integrated personality. Rather than having multiple personalities, people with DID probably better conceived of as actually at any given time having access to less than one. The compelling reason why it has remained, so underappreciated is that of all the conditions that one sees in psychiatry, it's extremely highly associated with a history of childhood, ongoing physical, sexual, emotional abuse, neglect, and the recognition, for example, of incest within society and within psychiatry has really only actually gained traction since the 1970s.
I mean, there has been a lot of controversy, continues to be, around this diagnosis, around whether it's a quote-unquote
real diagnosis, and we'll come to some of those later, but that's made you think quite deeply about the sorts of horrors, the extent of the inhumanity that happens in houses, in our streets, in our neighbourhoods. Mm-hmm. And you speak of a sort of collective denial. What are you getting at there?
I see it as part of the extension of society's resistance to anything to do with major trauma. Vietnam veterans, in their own way, suffered the same sorts of issues. We saw the same with Holocaust. I mean, Judith Herman, who wrote a beautiful book called Trauma and Recovery, makes the point that inherently society deals with trauma either by saying that accounts of it are exaggerated, or alternatively, it didn't happen at all. That, you know, the real cruncher comes along the lines of, well, it did happen, but it was actually your fault. And the effect of shame is an incredibly powerful mechanism for ensuring silence.
Psychiatrist Dr. Warwick Middleton, and you're with All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, going global on Radio Australia and online at abc.net.au/rn. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and we're hearing the personal experience today of Zoe Farris, who was diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder. A long-time performer and dancer, she now works in mental health support. Well, doctors thought that you had schizophrenia or perhaps borderline personality disorder.
Mainly because they said, do you hear voices? That's always the first question they ask. And I said, well, not really. I have thoughts that sort of are loud, but they're not mine. But other than that, that wasn't a big problem for me. It was losing time and waking up with self-harm marks on me, and for some reason I was just not coping.
But people around you in the nightclub scene that you were working in, you suggest, knew before you that you were living with multiple personalities.
Yes, they knew me as different people. I had different behaviours. In the nightclub scene in Sydney in the 80s, places like Stranded, Patches, The Exchange, in alternative clubs, weird behaviour was accepted. And it wasn't until I saw the doctor that I've got now, and looking at a movie, which was Sybil, I identified with the character in the story more than I did with real people. I said, that's got to say something.
Do you have a sense of the alters, the alternative selves? Who are they inside your host self, if you like?
I know more now than I did at the beginning of therapy. I didn't know any of them existed. I think the thing that freaked me out the most was being told that I was one of the others, is what I call the alters. So I wasn't what they call the firstborn. And it's funny, I said to my friend at the time, it's like finding out that you're adopted.
It's quite complicated what you've expressed there, because you're suggesting that you have multiple selves and that you, your core self, isn't necessarily the first that was born amongst those cells. I mean, who do you identify within yourself?
I can't say everyone's name or they'll freak out. There's Linda, who's about 10 years old. Everything is absolutely happy. And she makes this wee noise. I won't do it as loud as I can, but she's gone as soon as something upsetting happens. There's one I call the curled up one, and then there's the crying one, and that's basically what they do. There's the angry one, whose name I won't mention because in the letter. There's one that is so angry there's not many words. She doesn't say much. If she does, she might swear. And all she wants to do is hit things. But she won't hit things when people are around. I remember at work years ago, I'm not sure what happened, but I walked into the room and I just looked at one of my workmates and I said, you might want to leave now. Yeah, she understood. She saw it happening. So she just vanished and shut the door. For a long time, I kept a journal.
So who wrote in that journal? Your core self or
everybody?
Those dissociated selves?
Everybody. There's like three or four left-handeds, and there's right-handeds in different going left and going right, and really tiny little handwriting. And
what's it like reading the content of that diary?
I haven't read all of it because it's quite intense, but depending on what bit I open, I can tell who wrote it. And it's like, oh, I don't remember that. Oh, I was in a mood then.
At the most extreme, you get people, literally ended up in sort of other relationships, long-term relationships, having left, switched, and, ended up months later thinking, my God, where am I? Who is this person I'm with? That's at the very extreme. Most is not as extreme as that.
What causes a person to go on and sustain some of these dissociative identities and develop what you would call dissociative identity disorder. Why do they persist?
Good question. One of the reasons that they persist is, of course, is that the trauma never stops.
So people are constantly exposed to abuse in their relationships.
Relationships. The world seems slightly shocked when we read about cases like Joseph Fritzl, you know, who imprisoned his daughter for 24 years in a dungeon and had seven children with her. Except terrible as it is, probably Joseph Fritzl didn't need to go to the extent of excavating a dungeon to have the same amount of power, because so many other people effectively do the same thing by using psychological intimidation. The other reason why DID continues is, if you think about why somebody would create an alter state that all the other parts shun or avoid, it's usually because that particular compartment contains material that would otherwise be seen as toxic or overwhelming. So it's a bit like branding someone with a sort of a biohazard sticker, so everyone avoids them internally. So you have anger and shame and sexual functioning all contained within different parts. And it's a bit like, you know, a tribe separated by, you know, a floodwater and recombining years later, and suddenly you've got these, what used to be a cohesive group, are now warring factions.
How complex can the individual alters be in terms of the details of their behaviours and their personalities?
I mean, I'm just thinking of Tara here. And if you've seen the first episode, you would have met Buck, who's this male redneck alter who likes sort of automatic weapons and shooting and punching people out. And people can be caught out by this sort of switch. I remember one particular person who was a very petite, you know, short, innocuous, inoffensive sort of person in most of her usual states, but was late at night in some sort of altercation, you know, in Fortitude Valley, and some large policeman, you know, tried to intervene, whereupon she switched and literally knocked him out. And he was totally unsuspecting and totally unprepared. And afterwards, you know, in her usual state, had little memory of what had happened.
I thought it was normal not to remember school. I thought it was normal to lose time. One thing everyone can identify with is sitting in the car. All of a sudden you're at work, you didn't remember going past that, you didn't remember the lights. Everyone dissociates, and you daydream. That's what daydreaming is.
What's your experience of losing time?
Something will happen and I don't know what all my triggers are. Nowadays, I don't know, it feels like I'm backing off and things look further away, and sometimes I can see someone in front of me and they're dealing with it. If it's something that catches me off guard, the best thing to explain is that you blink, you open your eyes, and it's 2 days later or an hour later. I do know of one lady, I haven't seen her for about 10 years, and she couldn't work out why it was so hot, couldn't work out why there was four kids in the lounge room and not two. And then she realised she was in Australia. So she'd come to Australia, had two kids, and didn't know it. So, yeah, she'd lost 4 years.
The implication being that she'd been sort of occupying a different part of herself.
Yeah.
Our behaviours all exist on a continuum, and so can fly between angry, aggressive, happy, joyous, sad, and some people fly between those states of behaviour much more commonly than others. So how do you distinguish between that experience of multiple personalities or dissociation from that sort of continuum that everyone experiences?
Yeah, even people with dissociative identity disorder has those normal changes too. The me that I am, I behave differently at work than I do at home, but you're still you. No matter who you talk to or which attitude you're putting on, you're still Natasha. You know what I mean? When I used to perform on stage, it was still mostly me performing on stage. There was other times when I would be sitting backstage waiting to go on and the show would finish. And what I hadn't realised is I'd already been on, but I didn't remember doing it. So they saw me perform, but it wasn't me that did it. And that's the thing, I don't remember doing it.
Because it could be construed by folk, and I gather you've experienced people not believing that this is a real experience. It could be construed that somehow people in this situation aren't taking responsibility for an angry outburst, for example, if that's, for example, part of the series of personalities that one has.
I think you'll find that people with this condition are quite the opposite. They might say, oh, look, I don't remember that. But you know what? They're going to take responsibility for it. They're going to say, look, I don't remember that. If I did that, I'm really sorry. One thing I discovered, and I discovered this when I was having a short stay in hospital because I was losing too much time and waking up in too many weird suburbs up here, sometimes it's not the condition, it's the person themselves. So if you take away the condition, the person might be a really nice person or might be a bit of a mongrel. If you get someone who's going to blame their condition on everything that goes wrong, well, maybe that's how they are. I've got this thing that there's reasons for things, but there's not necessarily excuses for things.
People speak of having angry alters and childlike alters and, you know, sad alters, depressive alters. And I wonder, though, whether in some cases it could be the case that someone is hiving off an extreme angry self so as to not take responsibility for how their anger affects the people in their lives publicly.
Oh, I mean, you've hit on something that's important. I mean, at the end of the day, whether they're split into 20 parts or two parts or one part, is the point of the exercise is to take ownership of their life and to take personal responsibility. And people that are highly dissociative, as you point out, some can use their dissociation as a way of denying responsibility, such that, for example, you occasionally get someone who shoplifts and then says, but, you know, I have no memory of it and, you know, can you tell the police that, you know, I have a mental condition and can they let me go? Having said that, you know, people with DID have, you know, the full spectrum of personal attributes that you get in the general population. They range from just impeccable citizens who are incredibly productive, hard-working despite their condition, you know, through to, you know, rare examples of people who are serial killers. There's no such thing as, you know, the typical patient with DID.
This is a highly contested diagnosis. People have concerns that it doesn't exist, that it's a sort of a metaphor or a sort of narrative for a set of obviously very disturbing behaviours or experiences that are sort of projected by psychiatry onto an individual, and that that people sustain and reinforce their alters, their other personalities, in response partly to therapeutic suggestion. Or a sort of therapeutic narrative projected onto them. That's obviously a risk, isn't it?
The documentation of populations of people with DID, of their past history of abuse, the corroboration of that abuse, the corroboration of the fact that they've been dissociating for many years, even if it's been unrecognised, the amount of material that's been recorded on those issues is enormous. I mean, it is sort of interesting that you get this argument put forward from time to time, and I would say that with dissociative disorders, as with every other mental health condition, there are practitioners who are less than well trained or who go beyond the data or get involved in messy boundary problems. I don't think that's unique to DID. Whilst this stuff gets quoted, it's funny, I mean, I have directed a trauma and dissociation unit for 13 years, you know, have presented in this field at seminars and workshops and conferences repeatedly. I've been heavily involved in organising conferences on trauma and dissociation. It's whoever these people hold these views, they don't seem to be people who are actually willing to confront you face to face.
How do you approach this? Is the ultimate goal to reintegrate them into a complete self, to eliminate the alters, the other personalities?
No, it's not to eliminate anybody. In fact, it's unhelpful for people to sort of imply that everybody with dissociative identity disorder, as soon as they're correctly diagnosed, that they're on the royal road to recovery. The big problem with DID is it becomes maladaptive. What was a protective technique for surviving childhood becomes a very cumbersome technique for negotiating life as an adult, where, you know, you're trying to actually establish relationships, get a career, hold down a job. What you're trying to do, in fact, is actually get cooperation between the dissociated parts. And what you're trying to do is actually provide enough safety, get enough emotional reserves so that in a very graded way that you're actually allowing the stuff that otherwise drops on them and triggers them into maladaptive states can actually be held in consciousness so that they begin to function like people who don't dissociate.
There's also the risk of incredible re-traumatisation. I mean, to what extent do you go back, rake over the coals of previous traumas in order to allow a person to recognise what's going on internally for them? I mean, is there a therapeutic evidence base here for an approach that works the best?
It's it's actually unhelpful where people sort of manualize therapy and say, you know, by week 27 you should be doing this, because everyone is so different. What the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation put together, a freely available book which you can get via their website, which is Treatment Guidelines for Dissociative Identity Disorder, which is upgraded every 5 years. One of the messages you're giving all the time is that all parts are important. They were all created for reasons. But it's a bit like taking a very cluttered, you know, cloistered set of offices, each one with its own filing cabinet, its own door, and a very poor telephone system, and taking out all the internal partitions and turning it into an open plan office where everyone has access to the same data file. And I remember this is somebody who actually went on to finish her qualification as a health professional and marry and have children and basically have a life. But it's sort of amusing. I remember at one stage, at which point I think there were 17 different identified alters. And as you start to get a better handle on your dissociation and more cooperation, you start to attract more stable relationships and less self-harming feelings. And she'd actually met a young man, you know, and he was quite besotted with her. You know, he found her incredibly interesting and attractive. And I think after he'd known her for about 2 weeks, looked into her eyes and said, you know, you're the most together person I've ever met. And in fact, there were 17 different states that were sort of responding to that, but they were working cooperatively.
You've just said that the woman had 17 alters
at that point in time, I think, from memory, yeah.
Now, is that her identifying those, or is she unearthing them with a therapist? Because people have concerns about this sort of leading questioning that might reveal these identities in a person. How can you possibly identify 17 individual cells within the one?
A lot of these parts are actually facsimiles of each other, so slight variations on the one part. If you meet someone who has, for example, no sexual functioning, you have to think, well, where is that? Or someone who has no anger, where is that? Or someone who presents with, you know, slashes on the wrist but can't identify a memory of how it happened. You know, it's reasonable to think, well, maybe there's some other, considering there are already a number of parts, that there may be a part that's actually responsible for wrist slashing or burning or for, you know, having sex with strangers. And if therapy does go well and there are enough internal resources and reasonable qualities in the therapist, then you begin to see emerging of states, that there's less and less need to have all of this sort of messy office system and more, you know, functionality associated with an open plan office.
I've never had any desire or thought of legally taking action against anyone who did anything to me. It's one of those things that only in America, a lot of those cases came about because the perpetrator was jailed. And I know a few other people who did take perpetrators to court, and there was evidence of what they claimed. You know, I've got relatives who can tell you more about me than I know, that I haven't seen for 40 years. Yeah, so how can a doctor elicit that sort of, or put into somebody that sort of false memory or whatever you want to call it, when there's proof of it?
You've been working with a therapist for a long time. Has the aim of the therapy been about eliminating those alter cells or reintegrating them into one?
For me, integration wasn't an issue. I used to freak out at that term, and I wasn't the only one that freaked out. The others did too. For psychologists and therapists out there, what works is treat the person the way you would treat anybody else. My doctor never said, oh, you can't self-harm, you shouldn't self-harm. She said, I know it, I can't stop it, only you can stop it, but I'm here. Try to talk to me before it happens. For me, that was a bit hard because I didn't remember it happening, but once the others felt safe with her, I think that started happening.
Thank you for joining me on the program and talking about this experience so intimately.
Oh, it's all right. It's a pleasure.
And Zoe Farris has written a booklet, When We Means Me, published by the Queensland Association of Mental Health. It's out of print, but you can probably catch it in libraries. And before her, Professor Warwick Middleton, a Brisbane-based psychiatrist who's hosting two workshops this week in Brizzy and Melbourne on the condition. And also, The United States of Tara screens on Wednesday nights on ABC One, or catch it on ABC iView. More info, including links to papers critically analysing this diagnosis in some detail on the website, along with the audio, and my blog for your discussion, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. Thanks to Anita Barrow and Joel Church. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Catch you next week.
Next on Movie Time, Inglourious Basterds, our verdict plus the interview with Quentin Tarantino. And Greek-born Paris-based political filmmaker Costa Gavras will be in to talk about his latest. We rate the two new environmental documentaries that are fighting for the green box office dollar. And we review the September issue, a portrait of Vogue editor Anna Wintour. Movie Time. You can download this program from the Radio National website.